At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Beware, spoiler phobes. You have stumbled upon a storm of spoilers, a podcast about HBO's Game of Thrones series in conjunction with the Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. This discussion can expand to include any Game of Thrones relevant books, shows, internet extras, special features, teases, trailers, interviews, rumors, guesses, theories, and general crackpotitude. We're not ruining, we're enriching. After all, chaos isn't a pit, it's a ladder. You do not wish to be spoiled or are not caught up. Please stop now.
The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. The story we agree to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left? Gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder.
Hello, and welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I have seen all of Season 4 of Game of Thrones, but haven't read any of the books in George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire series.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series, as well as seen as much of the show as Dave has.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I have seen all of Season 4 at least twice, and I've read all of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Nice. You have tuned in for our wrap-up episode for Season 4 / this season of the podcast. It's inaugural season. But really quick, before we get into the Game of Thrones awesomeness, I wanted to point you to another podcast that I'm doing that I've invited Joanna along to. And I guess this is a good way to talk about it. Neil, have you ever seen The Legend of Korra on Nickelodeon?
No, but I hear you talk about it a lot on the Twitter.
Yeah. So what we're trying to do is motivate more people to watch it because it's really good and Nickelodeon is sort of abusing it. So if you, dear listener, get really into fantasy television shows and are a little hesitant because this one isn't based on a book, I've got good news for you. There's 3 seasons of a previous series that takes place earlier in the history. It's like having a book. There's a lot to dig into. It's at republiccitydispatch.com. And now let's talk about the more pressing adult conclusions.
Wait, I have a question first.
Oh, yes, yes. Please do.
This Legend of Korra thing, is it on the Netflix?
It is right now sort of in this weird limbo where because this season leaked early and they sort of needed to get it out there, Amazon and iTunes and Netflix, it's just not anywhere. We've been emailing Nickelodeon trying to figure out what's up, but the best place I could tell you right now is to go to nick.com. They have a lot of key episodes streaming, and I really hope that they get their act together because of demand and just make the whole series up to now available somewhere online.
All right, I kind of want to watch it now.
Yeah, well, it's super good, but here's a question, and then we should probably talk about the show we're here to talk about, but my question is, does it matter whether Nick is abusing it, because haven't they said they're going to do all 4 seasons?
We're definitely getting a conclusion to the Legend of Korra series, but there has been rumblings, and maybe we've heard privileged information rumors that these guys aren't necessarily done with this world after next season. But one step at a time, Joanna.
All right.
I'm going to check it out so that I can come and comment on your podcast.
Yes.
RepublicCityDispatch.com?
That is correct. We love all the synergy.
I was paying attention.
Yeah, but while we're taking that series one season at a time, your sort of listener call to arms this week was to fill out a form for us about how you thought the TV series would end, giving your knowledge of the TV and books, because you're smart listeners, we've learned through all your fantastic emails. I'm not exactly sure where to start with this. I guess we should talk about season four sort of greater. We asked what character you were most upset about not showing up. And unsurprisingly, Lady Stoneheart won that with a whopping 66% of the vote, which I think is the first thing we should talk about, because we should debate whether or not this whole conversation's moot now because of a certain Michelle Fairley interview that says Lady Stoneheart's never coming back.
It is not moot. It is not King's moot. It is not Queen's moot. It is still a viable conversation because Michelle Fairley said was all very like Benedict Cumberbatch's con of her. Like, she was saying that the character is dead. Well, no fucking sorry. Excuse my language. No.
No, we can do that on this podcast.
No, duh. You know, yeah, Catelyn's dead. I mean, technically everything she said did not preclude Lady Stoneheart from showing up, like, if you look at it. And I know that that makes me sound like an insane crackpot theorist, but I really think the option is still there. So
actually, that's an incredibly rational way to think about it, because of course she's not going to spoil it.
Right.
You know, like, of course they're not going to come out in an interview. Just like they didn't say the words Red Wedding before the Red Wedding episode. They're going to play that close to the vest no matter what. And there's still plenty of room for it in season five. So the fact that she said that she's not coming back has just no bearing whatsoever about whether or not she's actually coming back. I don't buy it for a second. I'm still holding out for Lady Stoneheart.
Exactly. Well, and at the same time, like, I won't be as disappointed next year if it doesn't happen as I was this year. But I'm, you know, I'm a believer, man. The truth is out there, Dave.
Yeah, it's not quite like Cold Hands where that ship has sailed.
Well, then what about Strong Belwas? Sailed ship, or will we just need to populate Marine at some point with more familiar comedy faces?
I mean, they could
It'd
put that in there
so
next year.
So weird for yeah, that to show up now.
I mean, they need more Marine characters.
That's
because they got that one guy and then that one other guy, and that's pretty much it.
Well, somebody took her dragon, so we know how that plays out. A whole bunch of two character scenes about what's up with her dragons.
Where are my dragons? Oh yeah, I chained them. That's right.
Where's my dragon?
Where's my Drogon?
Where's my Drogon? There you go. The rallying cry of season five.
Also, season four relevant. Everybody really enjoyed everything that had to do with Tyrion and everything that had to do with Oberyn in terms of we asked for our favorite thing about season four. Pretty much across the board, it was one of those two things. There's a few standouts. Someone said Arya killing Polliver, which is nice and brutal. And wasn't that stolen from one of the released chapters of the new book that we don't have yet?
Yeah.
Part of it?
Well, parts of it were from Winds of Winter, yeah.
Interesting. Well, that really worked for this person. And then head popping. No, that's still Oberyn.
It's pretty much all Oberyn.
It's all Oberyn. Which
makes
yeah.
me so happy.
We all agree with. That's the thing that they nailed. And the thing that people were not to jump ahead, but like the thing that people were most disappointed by was Dany. And I think everyone's right. Oberyn, best. Dany, bungled. Where's Lady Stoneheart? That's my review of season four.
you've looked at the data and what came out the other end.
That's my
it's
boiled
really
down recap.
Pretty simple way. But I do like that the Oberyn stuff really stuck out. Hopefully it stuck out for non-readers as well, because that them going, you know, they've begun talking about how season five is going to go to Dorne. I think that's really important. It's a lot of really good character stuff, a lot of really interesting characters, potentially more stuff for other characters we like to do down there if some of the rumblings are true about who's going to end up in Dorne.
I don't think we have to be cagey, right? We get to spoil all the speculation. Yeah,
sure. So that we were talking about this in the finale show about Jaime and potentially going to Dorne and maybe taking Bronn with him and getting more characters like Oberyn with that same kind of charm and that swagger and all of his crazy awesome warrior daughters. I think it really sets up very well for season five, because I'm a little worried about a lot of the season five stuff. That's the one thing I think they will get right no matter what, is how cool Dorne is. So, you know.
And it's interesting that you bring up this idea of book. I forgot to take into consideration that these are all book reader or at least spoiled people's responses. And so it could be that if you take the wider poll, I mean, I think Oberyn will still win, but I don't know that people will be quite so frustrated with the Dany stuff if they don't know how potentially emotionally affecting it could have been, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're missing, possibly. But as for next year, I mean, like, it's got to end next year with Dany riding off on her dragon, right?
That seems like a really great, you know, climactic moment. CG shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know what we're going to do with her for all of those episodes. I mean, she definitely has some plot.
She's going to get married again.
Yeah, but does she have 10 episodes worth of plot? Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe if they bring in Strong Belwas.
Right. Fingers crossed.
It's weird to like not have that character, because it's another one where it's like there's a huge like plot moment later, like right as at the fighting pits, where they discover that, you know, Hisdar has poisoned the locust that they're eating, and it's Belwas that eats him. I mean, granted, like anybody I guess could eat him, but like you kind of find out that he's turned on her, so it's weird that character's not there yet, because it feels like something they should be setting up for much later.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder, I mean, is that important enough a moment to do like a mash, or?
I guess they could substitute a different character in there, or they could just introduce a placeholder character to have that moment, but it is a big enough moment, because like, I feel like that's the moment where like everybody around Dany realizes that Hisdar Zolorok is a douchebag, basically.
Well, could it, yeah.
Grey Worm, were you going to say?
That's what I was going to say, yeah. And that will be much more tragic, because then there'll be the added, like, Missandei Grey Worm love story thing.
Right. The non-sexual love story.
Right. But to give it that much more, I mean, I think Grey Worm is definitely going to die. Either he's going to be a stand-in for Missandei's brother who dies, or something else is going to happen.
Yeah, he's just too darn likable to live.
He's just a little puppy dog, merciless killer person. So, yeah.
I'm looking at the responses by John L., who seems to be a contrarian, because his best moment of season four was all caps, giant killing someone on top of the wall with a bow and arrow, which was awesome. And then his worst part about season four, given all of season four, was not putting the Stannis scene in episode 9. So that just seems like
it's such a weird logistics thing.
I like the responses, because really he just wants to change one episode, and like that would have done everything for him. Everybody else is like, oh, this character had like some sort of diluting, or like Shay had this weird sort of like fitting into a hole. I have a weird respect for a person that's just like, just this one episode, if it would have ended a little later, that would have been nice.
Yeah, you gotta respect that. It does, I think all of these, not all of them, but most of them, there's a lot of very specific stuff that people are, upset about. I think overall it shows a overwhelmingly solid season of Game of Thrones. And I think that's a big thing to me, is like a lot of stuff they didn't like was, you know, I see a lot of the Jaime Cersei rape scene, obviously.
That someone just put Alex Graves.
Yeah. But it feels like for the most part, there were a few specific things that season four did poorly, but on the whole, awesome.
Yeah. And then I really like how it seems like when people really tuned in to what they liked, it was something about the TV show, and the worst part was just something they weren't expecting from coming from the books, which I can't fault anybody for. I love things too, and then hate when they don't happen.
Yeah. So, and we're all sad about the Tisha thing. My roommate won't let that go. The Tisha thing. It's like, that's the thing that really ruined it. But it, and everybody who is mad about it is right, because that's a lot of the emotional punch of him killing his father revolves around the Tisha thing. So,
well, and the question is, I mean, fine, they're not going to have it going forward, but it seemed like such a driving motivation for him going forward. Mm-hmm. So then what is his driving motivation going to be? Is he going to be a completely different character than he is in the book and just a much cooler, more likable Peter Dinklage character? Possibly, you know?
Maybe.
And maybe that'll make for more entertaining television because Tyrion was, you know, not the greatest character to be around in, you know, his later stuff. So,
yeah.
And not that that, and I... Not like everyone has to be likable and zippy and whatever in order for me to enjoy their story, but maybe there's enough grimness in the story that they need that balance. And I think I talked about this in our finale episode that Dave's Fighting the War Room co-host, Katie Rich, said that she wouldn't have been able to watch the show if it had been as dark as it was in the books. Mm-hmm.
It's weird because usually it's the show making it more brutal than the books.
Yeah, just the fact that when he said sorry after he strangled her was capable of being a laugh line, I think was the moment that I realized that it didn't have all the punch that I was promised it would have. And that I think I told everybody not to worry because Peter Dinklage could pull it off, which he did really well considering he had to do it all with his face, but without the backstory... I don't know. It seems like a murder of convenience. Like he didn't need to be there in the real world. And I hate that type of criticism that's just picking out continuity errors. But in this case, it didn't need to be there. They had explanation.
Also, wherever whores go is like my only cat.
Right.
Like it's one of my favorite things that lasts throughout book five where he just walks up to everybody. And he's basically just like, where do whores go? I wanted that for the show. Like, I wanted those weird moments where Tyrion's just asking random people, where do whores go? So, but it all happens in his head in the books for the most part. So, I guess you can't.
He's living that right now in his little box. That's all he's thinking about on his boat ride.
Barriss just, like, hears it sort of come, like, out of the box occasionally. Where do whores go?
What? And Barriss is like, I don't know. You're talking to the wrong guy here.
There's like, I'm not even supposed to be on this boat. Right. P.S. Can we take a quick break just to say that, I mean, Dave, I'm sure you have a more formal announcement planned for this at the end of the podcast, but I do want to tell people that we have...
You're just gonna, can't hold it in any longer.
Well, I just want to say it because sometimes people don't stick around for the end of the podcast. So I'm just going to tease it and then stick around for more details. We have Everyone's on a Boat t-shirts. They're amazing. And we will announce more details about when and how you can get them. But we've all seen the design. It's really good. So
it's exceptional.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not going to be a contest. You're going to be able to get one if you want one really bad. So let's do it.
It's not going to be like a Mondo poster.
That's right.
No, they're going to be available. I just didn't want people to like, you know, skip the end and miss the t-shirt. Pitch,
yeah, no, so. It's cool. You just buy seven and then wear one every day until Game of Thrones comes back, and things will be great.
And then we'll get Winds of Winter. Like what I've been told is that if you buy seven, wear one every day, we'll get Winds of Winter by Christmas from George R. R. Martin.
I'm gonna buy one seven for everybody then.
All right.
Well, I mean, that's got to be at least as good as, what, $20,000 to get into the book. But I guess that's neither here nor there.
Oh, the Wolf Sanctuary contest?
Yeah, that's... Yeah. I mean, it could have at
we
least
should
given
have done
me a t-shirt.
Kickstarter to get, like, us in that.
The three of us.
I feel like that's the best use of a Kickstarter I can think of.
What's that guy's name again, Dave?
George R.R. Martin?
No, I don't remember it is, but it's something that cannot be in the books.
It's just super ordinary. The person who won has a super duper ordinary modern name.
It's like Joe Thompson or something.
And it's like, because you could do House Thompson, I feel like, and get away with it. But this is like, how is this going to blend? Anyway.
I'm going to look it up right now. You gotta keep talking.
Talk amongst yourselves. Okay, I'll ramble a bit more.
Anyway, so this t-shirt's pretty awesome.
It's really, really cool. And we're gonna put it on sale with a couple of the Cast of Kings shirts too. So you're gonna have three options. But On a Boat is your spoilery choice.
I'll let you guys know. I've already pre-ordered one. So this is how, I mean, you really need to get in on this.
I think you're supposed to say you already pre-ordered seven.
Damn it.
Right?
Seven. I pre-ordered seven.
Seven. What?
All right, if this page is loading, but you guys are doing a really good job. We don't have to keep talking about Weird George R. Martin book guy. I'll come back to it when I actually have an answer.
Okay.
The other half of this poll that we took was concerning the future of the TV series, knowing what we know about the show. So it's not how the books are going to end, because as somebody pointed out very nicely, there's a few more books left. You're not necessarily how many, and lots of stuff can change, whereas the TV show, at least you would think, is building towards what George R. Martin has said the ending is. So our question that I guess we sort of kicked off with before our essay portion was, who is ultimately on the Iron Throne? And the winner was the last Targaryen, Jon Snow.
The missing Targaryen.
The missing Targaryen, which we may get to know about because we might be doing flashbacks next season.
Yeah.
Did we talk about that?
That they are, like, casting a younger Cersei for flashbacks?
Yeah.
So the rumor mill goes? Yeah.
Is that going to be, like...
Well, because they have to put in, what's her name? Maggie the frog? Or whatever.
I mean, do they have to put in anything at this point?
Well, no, they don't have to, but that's one of the characters on the list.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You're right.
The fortune teller that talks about how Cersei's gonna have a tough time, and then Cersei has a tough time. It's great. I love it when stuff pays off.
So explain this to me a little bit. There's a character that requires Cersei have a flashback.
Well, so there's like a fortune teller, if I remember it correctly, in Cersei's backstory that told her something bad was gonna happen.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on. It's Maggie the Frog prophecy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the Maggie the Frog prophecy is a fortune teller in Lannisport. And she tells Cersei, seeks her out as a young girl and tells her some stuff.
Oh, it's tells bad. Her that someone younger, more beautiful. It's like a Snow White thing, right?
Yeah, someone younger, more beautiful will come along and shit all over your life. So basically Cersei begins to believe that that's Margaery, and that's sort of what fuels a lot of her undoing with, you know, in King's Landing with the High Sparrow and mm-hmm. trying to frame Margaery for being, kingdom slut. I think that's pretty much the way to sum it up, is she basically paints Margaery as this giant slut and goes, "Hey, church, you got to get this girl." And then,
so why do it in flashback, and why not do a Harry Potter Hall of Prophecies something?
I
don't think King's Landing has one of those.
It's interesting that they didn't like think of just having her bump into some crone somewhere who told her something. Do you know? It is interesting that they would have
somebody.
It so removed. Well, that's what I mean. Yeah, just like that the prophecy can't come now to her, because it seems weird since they haven't mentioned it that it's going to be somehow very important. But it is true that Maggie the Frog is on the casting list, so that is happening.
I think the reason that it's important that it happens to Cersei at a young age is that it does fuel a lot of her, because there is part of the prophecy, and I apologize for not knowing it word for word. I gotta reread these stupid books. It's killing me. But there is something about her little brother in there. So it kind of explains some of the additional hate that she has for Tyrion. And it explains why it becomes relevant after Tyrion kills Tywin, that she starts thinking back about this. So I think it matters for Cersei's character that it happened early in life, because it explains a lot of why she's such a kind of a crazy bitch as an adult.
Right.
So her, having it happen to her just randomly on the street in King's Landing present day would be a weird thing.
Maybe. I mean, it's interesting to me that this is what they chose to be like, and this is the flashback story that's most important to us. Like, okay, you have a history of a lot of things that you just gave to Joffrey to talk about one time that I would have liked to see a flashback of in some way. But good to know. So we may never know that Jon Snow is the last Targaryen until someone tells us, or maybe we'll actually get to see it. But either way, you guys overwhelmingly think he's going to end up on the Iron Throne, followed closely by no one and Daenerys, which, based on the title of the book series, A Song of Ice and Fire, I was expecting those two to be the top answers.
I do think it's interesting that a lot of people had Jon Snow kind of and Daenerys.
It felt like married.
Getting right? Hitched.
Yeah.
Which really leads me into my theory of why you're all wrong.
Go for it, dude.
So here's why Stannis is going to be the king. Well, and so here's what my mind is trying to do. My mind is trying to psychoanalyze George Martin, and this is just crazy. And this is where it sort of jumps off of the boat that everyone's on. So think about it this way. Every time, I think George R. R. Martin's the ultimate things that happen to people are very pragmatic things, and it's all cause and effect. So, like, you know, Robb Stark and his family were murdered because of the choice that he made. Joffrey dies ultimately because Stannis threw leeches into the fire and has some magic going. So everybody's death seems to be, you know, Tywin died because he was shitty to his son basically his entire life. And so there's this cause and effect. And everything you want to happen, all these starry-eyed traditional hero story victory things, basically think of whatever the opposite of that is, and that's probably what's going to happen. So if we think about, like, the best, coolest case scenario, it is, yeah, it's Jon Snow is a secret Targaryen, he marries Daenerys, they have sweet Targaryen babies, they all ride dragons. No. The more logical thing to happen is that there is a great battle between darkness and light, and the dragons fight for the light, the White Walkers fight for the darkness. Those two things essentially just kill each other and cancel each other out. And then what's left? The guy who won't die, Stannis.
What you're pitching to me sounds a lot like Noah, in my mind, what the end of the world looks like. It's like, and then there's this one guy who just knew there was one God and just sort of stumbled through the world and then, oh, hey, prophet.
And in the end, it's just basically a big conservative thing where it's just like, oh, and now we prove that there's only one God. And we find out that George R. R. Martin's like this crazy Republican.
And he had like a neocon agenda this whole time.
Yep. And he faked us all into it. And Game of Thrones just led us right down the path. And we're all just like, Lord of Light, I get it. All right.
That'd be great. I would...
He would get points for that in my book. If that's the long game, wouldn't agree, but I'd be like, oh, all right, I get you.
He'd dethrone Karl Rove as like the most person I hate most of the neocon world.
Good job, George.
Yeah, he executed.
Well,
it would make sense.
I think most people are presuming that Jon is not actually dead at the end of A Dance with Dragons. So that means he's probably not going to die in the series. You can't have him die twice, right? I mean, you could, but that would be terrible. So thankfully, a lot of people in their predictions of how the show would end did mention Dany dying. And I think that that's the more, you know, that's the better ending. Not Jon on the throne by any means, but one of those two definitely dying. No walking off into the sunset together, for sure. But I don't know if that means that it's Stannis on the throne. I liked, a lot of our listeners suggested Tommen on the throne, which I kind of really like. Mm-hmm. Or a lot of them suggested no throne whatsoever, which is also interesting. And my favorite, I don't know if I'm like messing up your plan, Dave, to talk about it, but like my favorite thing that people talked about was Sansa taking down Littlefinger. And what I really like is the idea of Littlefinger manipulating his way just like within a hair's breadth of the throne and then Sansa taking him out somehow. Now, I know that that's a fairly typical arc. And so if we're going to go with George R. R. Martin's a wild and crazy guy and is not going to give us what we expect, you know, like Sansa's going to die or whatever. But I don't know. I really like Sansa taking Littlefinger.
Or maybe Sansa
out.
Tries to turn things around on Littlefinger and he kills her.
Maybe.
Like that's how I feel like that would happen. I also feel like Arya is going to kill Tyrion, like, right at the end.
That would be perfect. Just, I mean, something like that. And
just to fucking drive it home.
Weiss and Benioff, I guess. I hadn't seen this, but one of our listeners said that they call the ending 100% satisfying.
Oh, I doubt it.
Well, it depends on your definition of satisfying, right?
Yeah, I guess.
And so there is a certain satisfaction to be derived from something like Arya killing Tyrion. I'd be like, that's perfect. That sums up Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. Or vice versa.
One of our listeners had a like super happy ending where everybody ends the up Wayne's in Winterfell. World
version. Yeah, the Wayne's World version. I love that.
Yeah, and then there was also another one that sort of took a Princess Bride version, I feel, even to the point where at the end, the final shot is John telling the Song of Ice and Fire to his daughter Ygritte.
You people have lost it. I love it.
The only thing that I think I would put more weight on people's guesses of the ending is it would baffle me that we would focus in the TV show so much on the Stark family and not have somebody from the Stark family end up in the power position at the end of the show.
I do think was there one in here, did I read in our spreadsheet, or maybe I read this somewhere else, where there was this idea that the kingdoms split apart into seven kingdoms, and there's seven different rulers at the end. Like, you know, Rickon ends up ruling the north, and Tommen ends up ruling, you know, the crown lands. And
so, like, baby kings?
Yeah, well, I mean, it just kind of breaks up to where it was before they were conquered by the Targaryens. You know, it's just seven kingdoms. And I think that's kind of an interesting one. I do think my Stannis theory does come along with, like, that shot in Bran's vision that we've seen several times of, like, the throne room basically destroyed and Winter going over it. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea is everything's destroyed and everybody's pretty much dead and Stannis is just the only one left. Like, I don't think he, like, wins. I think he's just the only one that doesn't die. So he just goes back to Dragonstone and doesn't win and nobody wins.
Everyone dies and Stannis has to, like, live with the consequences
right.
of boning Melisandre. That's an interesting ending. That is interesting though. Snow, well, I think it's supposed to be symbolic, isn't it? Like Snow in the throne room is like Jon Snow in the throne room or whatever, and then the dragon flying over King's Landing is, I mean, I guess it could actually be a dragon flying over King's Landing.
Or maybe the dragons come and destroy King's Landing and then just go away.
But like a lot of the theories, too, about how it's going to end is some big battle, some big showdown between the whites and the dragons and all this stuff. And I think that would be so boring.
I think that happens early. Like, I feel like that just happens and then they all die. Like, they just get killed. And I do, there was something that I read about the idea of balance. The idea that, you know, the White Walkers showed up around the same time as Dany's dragons were born in that season one area. Mm-hmm. And so in order for the balance to come back, they all have to die fighting each other. So like the balance of magic in the realm has to go back to like a zero sum.
If you want to see a dragon die,
I think all three dragons are going to die.
So does that have anything to do with like the comet that we saw at the beginning of the series? Cause that was supposed to signify the birth of the dragons, but you think that signifies a balancing of the scales?
Yeah, I feel like that signified like the oncoming rise in magic or the supernatural elements. But I think all these supernatural elements, there's going to be this, you know, this reckoning. Rebalancing. Yeah, this reckoning, this rebalancing, which would then ultimately explain like the doom of Valyria and stuff like that. So I think there's precedent in the books when you read some of the backstories for this idea that this world kind of balances and unbalances itself with these supernatural elements. You know, this huge these harsh long winters and these, you know, the wall, you know, and all these, like the fact that the wall is magic and the Andals you know, holding back all the supernatural things in the north. There's like these weird senses of balance throughout. And I think that that is what leads me to believe that there's going to be this huge, well, not even necessarily a huge battle, but there will be a battle in which the dragons and the White Walkers essentially cancel each other out.
And then Rickon ends up on the throne, as one of our readers suggested. As the last surviving royal.
I like the other Rickon theory was that he just gets as many walnuts as he wants for the rest of his life, so he can smash them. Well, no, I like what you have to say. It's sort of about pendulums of history swinging back and forth. I think that's smart. I just think it would be boring to culminate in a big battle that's so Return of the King, which, you know, George R. R. Martin has talked about wanting to do something different than Return of the King. But if it happened not in the last book, but in the second to last book, mm-hmm. and then there's aftermath from that, or as you say, like maybe at the beginning of the last book is the battle, and then we get the aftermath, because I just think that the personal drama, you know, these little moments of like, not little moments, but these moments of like Sansa and Littlefinger, how is that going to play out? Or Arya, like the battle for Arya's soul, or who's going to die when? Like, that's so much more interesting to me than them dying on a battlefield of some sort, you know?
I like that idea. And once again, Neil should watch Korra, because their second season ended with the ultimate battle between good and evil. And now we just have to figure out what's happening after that. So it's been, I really like that dynamic, because it's no longer, the only status quo is what we know about the characters. And especially for a fantasy show that spent so much time world building, I think it's a really cool reversal to suddenly change the world once it's been established fully. And that, you know, gives over to your characters to provide a solution that you're going to like, because it comes from character, instead of just, wouldn't it be great to have a shot of a dinosaur fighting a zombie, which I agree would be fantastic, and we should get some of that, but I don't think it needs to be our...
I really do like that idea, and I like the idea of the visual of maybe the wall falling that mm-hmm. that kind of leads to them having to, you know, rally and fight the White Walkers, because otherwise there's really no reason, because the wall keeps them at bay.
Well, apparently there's a dragon inside the wall, like someone let me know. Oh, and...
Well, no, oh, yeah, okay, right. so that is a theory, that there's an ice dragon baked into the wall, much like that scythe was, I guess. So, you know, Dave was asking me about that. He's like, what's up with ice dragons?
There's a lot of stuff in the wall.
I think that would be crazy if the wall came down and there was, like, the ice dragon, and then, I don't know, yeah, other shit.
Hey,
I found this ring, and...
It would freak me out, because...
Another magical sword, and...
In the Wizarding World of Harry Potter in Orlando, Florida, the roller coaster that's there used to be called the Dueling Dragons, and it was a red fire dragon and a blue ice dragon. And if I've already read the conclusion of Game of Thrones as a roller coaster, I'm not sure I need to see it.
Well, I mean, the reason that ice dragons are often dismissed as a theory, you know, and it's not even confirmed that they exist. It's sort of like folklore. But the reason they're dismissed is, like, the whole point of the ice and fire, other than, like, oh, John and Danny or whatever, is the ice zombies versus the dragons, which are the source of the fire, right?
Right.
What good is an ice dragon against something that's, like, made of ice? You know, the ice dragons won't be too useful in that battle. Unless it's ice dragon versus fire dragon, which is crazy. I just don't want a big CGI dragon. I already watched Reign of Fire. I don't want a big CGI dragon fight ending Game of Thrones. I want something like
that. Was not what Reign of Fire was about. Wait, don't make promises about Reign of Fire. It is all human on dragon. Go ahead.
I know. I have seen that.
I do. I mean, I like the idea of the battle happening, because I think that there's a lot of visual currency to that. But I do want it to happen early and have a lot more after that, like the fallout of that. I do think that's an interesting moment for like someone like Dany to die, like saving the realm. You know, the Targaryen mm-hmm. line basically ends with them saving the realm from the Eternal Winter. I've always thought of the ice and fire thing after reading the books as the two ideas of religion, like the mm-hmm. Lord of Light and then the Lord of Eternal Winter, essentially the Night's King being the other side of that coin. But I don't know. I don't know how the other religions fit into that, like the new gods and the old gods. And
well, I mean, like how many of those things are? See, in order to speculate, I feel like I need to ask some questions. Three-eyed Raven, what's his purpose with the children? Somebody refresh me. In the world,
just to be part of a tree.
That's what he does.
He's
a vision to somebody.
He's into the network.
Well, in the ultimate power that Bran has is that Bran can see backwards and forwards in time. Bran can see everything that's going on. I think that gives season 5 an interesting like plot device, which is Bran, his ability to kind of see things, which might also explain the flashbacks, maybe.
I hope so. That would make me feel better.
But yeah, I don't think we've gotten enough, because, you know, like we said last, in our last episode, we've really reached the end of the Bran story in the books, in the show as well. So we don't really know what that plays into. You know, they can use animals. They can warg into animals, and they can talk through the trees, and the trees see all the events, you know, forward and backward. But
so they might be super important, or they might be like watchers.
Yeah, the tree network really bothers me, and I feel like they can't really go there with the show. I mean, I guess they can because he was already kind of like the three-eyed crow is sort of tapped into the tree network. And I guess the presumptive, like, or the expected thing is for Bran to take over that position and into the tree network in that guy's place.
He's going to warg into a dragon, and then that dragon's just going to die, and Bran's going to die. It's going to be...
Or, like, one of the theories that we got was that, like, Bran dies, but just before he dies, he wargs into a dragon, so then he's, like, forever a dragon.
Yeah, that makes me think of Animorphs, though, where then you lose yourself in the dragon brain.
Well, right? That's what they talk about in the book a lot, him losing himself in the direwolf brain. Like, it makes more sense to me that he would forever warg into a wolf. But I guess he has to fly, so I don't know.
Well, he could just be warging all over the place. Everybody's going to be warging. All right, second clarifying question, because I didn't read enough wikis. Azor Ahai? Is what?
He's like the savior reborn, basically. And
he's basically the Jesus figure.
Yeah, he's basically Jesus, and Melisandre this whole time has been saying that it's Stannis. But... you know, most people think it's Jon instead.
The way she was looking at Jon Snow at the end of that last episode.
Yeah.
She sees a little something.
She sees a little something, something. She sees a little Targaryen blood in him is what she sees.
Maybe that's why they need Stannis' daughter. And marry her to Jon Snow.
Maybe. I think that they're going to... I already talked about this, but I think they're going to use her to replace Mance Rayder's kid as, like, the person that Melisandre tries to sacrifice.
Hmm.
You know, instead of going after a baby, she's going to go after Shireen. But yeah, John is Jesus. And, you know.
Yeah, that just came up a lot. And I was like, who's this person that everybody thinks is going to have something to do with the end? So he's like Lord of Light Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yay. The part of me that likes talking about religion is super psyched. The part of me that does not like Deus Ex Machina, less so with the resurrection of Jon Snow Jesus. And, okay, I want to...
Jon Snow Jesus is going to be so great. Like, the resurrection of Jon Snow Jesus is just... And, I mean, I think that's why you have to have Lady Stoneheart. Not just
it explains
for the
resurrection power of the Lord of Light.
Exactly. Not just for, like... this great theory that Lady Stoneheart is the one who comes and resurrects Jon Snow, like, and how that's an interesting capper to Catelyn's battle relationship with Jon Snow.
She
and
was
how
kind
like
of mad at him all the time.
Yeah. And so like in the end, she's the one who saves him. Like that would be some interesting dramatic irony. But also, yeah, just to keep it fresh in our minds that people can be resurrected in this world. And so
what if Jon Snow marries Lady Stoneheart?
Oh my God, I would go to that wedding.
And then everybody goes to the wedding and everyone else gets murdered. And it's just the two undead people at the end. Mine's blown.
Then zombies inherited the earth.
Well, my favorite thing that I was sort of reading up on, refreshing my memory on today, was the Northern Conspiracy, which they can't go into too much on the show because they haven't established all the Northern Lords like they do in the books. But... in the books, there's this whole idea that, like, you know, so eventually what we're going to get is we're going to get the Northern Lords working with Stannis. And this Northern conspiracy is that the Northern Lords are just jollying Stannis along because they know that Robb, like, legitimized Jon Snow and wants Jon Snow to be their, you know, king, basically. And so they're jollying Stannis along until they can, like, pull a bait and switch and make Jon their leader.
Well, and they also kind of jolly him along so that he can get rid of Bolton.
Right. I mean, no matter what, the Northern Lords are jollying Stannis along for their own gain. But the Northern Conspiracy is probably a crackpot theory. But first of all, it's got a great name. Northern Conspiracy is great.
That's what you got. I mean, you got to have a good name.
Yeah, you, I mean, it's like the, you know, the Lannister honeypot theory. Like, you know, if as long as you got a catchy name, like, people are going to come along for the ride. Anyway, I like that theory. I like the theory that Lady Stoneheart saves Jon Snow. I like a lot of crackpot theories. I'm really into them. So the more the show strips away my hopes for that by, like, not introducing any Northern Lords or, you know, not using Lady Stoneheart at all, the more bummed I am. And that's the problem of being a book reader and getting too attached to your theories and then watching the show strip it away. It's not the show's fault. It's just the show is a different thing, but it's so hard to separate them. So,
yeah, it's always nice to have this time to process instead of just immediately having the emotional reaction, which I had this season just from talking to you guys and learning to expect things like less than a week before the episode was actually going to air. And then like feeling the crushing defeat when zombie Catelyn didn't show up.
Well, it's like that whole thing. I was reading, Ryan McGee wrote an interesting post about sort of the return of community last night on his blog. It's called like BoobTube Dude, I believe, or something. And but anyway, he talked about how long he spent writing about Lost. And I wasn't like reading his stuff at the time, but I guess he wrote about Lost like every day for years. And Lost was the exact same kind of thing where you could just get fall down the rabbit hole of theories and conspiracies or whatever. And then what happens right at the end, and this happened in True Detective and it happened in like basically in like How I Met Your Mother, is everyone's trying to be more right than the show or just figure, they want to be the one who figured it out. And then if the show doesn't do what you figured it out, you're pissed. And then if the show does what you figured out, you're pissed because it's predictable. You know, and if it doesn't do what you wanted, then your ending would have been better. And so it just becomes this sort of arms race of like who can figure out, you know, the conclusion. And that's problematic. It makes it really hard to enjoy something when you're caught up in that. It's fun to theorize. I'm just saying, as long as that theorizing doesn't destroy your ability to enjoy whatever ending the writers or the showrunners have come up with.
I agree with that, but I think it's also, I think this is why it's important to do rewatches and things, is because I think it's also important to let yourself have that reaction, because like the reason we criticize episodes from week to week is because there isn't another episode. It's not Orange is the New Black. If that happened, we would just watch all of Game of Thrones and sit back and then talk about what went wrong.
And we all would have liked the stuff at the wall this year if we all would have just watched it straight through.
Yeah, because it just would have been like one complete little nugget like people wanted. Whereas it's like, I understand that it's not necessarily helpful to set unreal expectations for yourself for a finale, but I do feel like it's unavoidable, because if you really love something, that's the level you have to engage with it at. So I think it's like a trust fall at the end of a series where all of fandom feels horrible and, you know, you polarize and Battlestar Galactica was the best thing for involving God or the worst thing for involving God. And And then 6 months later, when you start Battlestar Galactica season one again, and you realize that the God question was the only question they were ever interested in, and it all becomes this complete little egg, then you can appreciate the show for what it is instead of the thing that you needed it to be, which is ultimately which makes things dangerous in the fact that we live in a world where if a TV show doesn't want to be canceled, it's not going to be canceled. But that's a different topic for, I'm sure, maybe another season of Game of Thrones or maybe another show entirely.
Well, I think it's better, I think, to ingest something as a whole, as in approach a book series that's already been completed. I just mean you don't fall down that like years in between books. So all we have to do is just re-chew over these hints and stuff like that, which can be fun and is fun for me too. And like the Northern conspiracy theory, but like then if the Northern conspiracy does not pan out, I shouldn't get angry, you know? And that's the danger.
I mean, I think you can get angry. It's just a matter of what you do with that passion. And if your response is to, you know, stalk one of the writers on Twitter, you're doing it wrong. But I mean, like, being mad at a show the day after the finale, I think, is like a American television experience.
I guess the day after, but like the abuse that Lost gets years after is, I mean, I didn't love the Lost ending.
Is that its own fault?
Yeah, but I didn't love the Lost ending, but that doesn't mean that I didn't love like all of the seasons leading up to the Lost ending. Like an ending that happens in like, you know, a Unitarian Universalist chapter in the sky or whatever is like not what I wanted necessarily, but I don't even know what I wanted. But I enjoyed getting there. So why is Lost's biggest legacy a disappointing ending? I'm getting way off topic.
No, that's fine. It was a show that, you know, grabbed a zeitgeist. And when Game of Thrones ends, somebody's going to ask, are we done adapting book series? Because Game of Thrones ended like blank. But I mean, it's weird because something with Lost specifically, it was my dissatisfaction with the ending that allowed me to dive back into the series as often and as deep as I did. Like that's still a motivating factor. Like being pissed at how a series that you loved for so long in the correct way ended in an incorrect way can still be a fire in your belly to do something positive with your fandom or storytelling acumen or way you think about the world. I don't know. I met some people who react to things that I love in ways that I never would. People that still collect like mint edition collections of comic books or very specific toys, things like that, or who need, you know, like error versions of toys where they printed one where Flanders is facing backwards in the bubble wrap and that's like their life depends on them getting this like weird Simpsons action figure. I look at it and I feel like they're making themselves more sad, but I don't know what happens with their brain releasing endorphins when they finally get their hands on that action figure, or if it's releasing endorphins just searching eBay every night for that action figure, and if that's good or bad in the way we love things.
I think I figured it out.
Okay, yes, thank you.
I think what you guys are really saying here is that we need to get Damon Lindelof and George R. R. Martin, give them swords, and have them do Battle Royale. Because it's pretty much just their fault.
Yeah, and then the one that dies turns into black smoke and then haunts the other for all of eternity.
Right, and then we have to build a wall to keep them out.
That's how our loop starts.
Pretty sure that's what I got from what you guys.
And then Ron, and then Ron D. Moore is going to be on the Iron Throne at the end. No,
okay. I'm good with that. That sounds good. I really like Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, no, I mean he's doing more to hurt his reputation now than he did by ending Battlestar Galactica.
You mean with Outlander? Outlander, which is like one of a few shows that hopes to be the next Game of Thrones. Outlander's so stupid. I don't even know what to tell you.
Man, I didn't even get to Outlander. I got like 5 minutes into Vikings and I was like, nope. I don't know.
Outlander is based on an immensely popular ongoing series of books about, I'm not kidding you, a woman who time travels to like medieval Scotland and then time travels around, and it's like a love story with time travel and men in kilts, and it's crazy popular.
Does she at any point say there can only be one Outlander? So I feel like that's the only reason.
His name is Duncan MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod. No, and so like, yeah, so Ron Moore is basically, and he's making it for Stars, and it's basically going to be like a bodice ripper, but I think it really wants to be Game of Thrones, because they're like, okay, what's another sci-fi fantasy series that's as popular as Game of Thrones was? Outlander, which is true, but it's like the Twilight of Game of Thrones, and I'm really
like
bummed.
It's like the porn knockoff,
basically. Yeah.
I don't know, I might watch that.
this is an interesting pivot point, but considering you just talked about an adaptation you hated, if you remember correctly, you're supposed to bring an adaptation that you love, Joanna, to recommend to people.
I forgot about my homework. Did you do your homework?
Oh, of course I did my homework. Okay. Did Neil, did you do your homework?
Who? What?
Do you have an adaptation that you love?
You guys go first.
Yeah. I guess I'll go first.
Mine
is very, very far reaching, but talking to you, the book loving audience, I would recommend that you get volumes 1 and 2 of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen by Alan Moore. It is a comic book that is sort of literary mash fiction where all these literary references are not only the main characters of the book, also pop up in all the comic book panels. And because it's Alan Moore, it's not a straight like comic book read. There's tons of straight up prose. There's old what's-its. I guess if you have to, old what's-its is not a descriptor of anything. I apologize that I said that. He rips off previous incarnations of the graphic form, be they old pornographic magazines that they would pass around during World War I, or ads in the 1600s in London. But it smashes together all these different fictional things. Alan Quartermain's one of the heroes, the lead lady from Dracula, Mina, whatever.
Parker.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, so I've read, I think, like one issue, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, then I saw the like terrible film.
Oh, God, no, don't ever see the movie. That's different.
And it's what Penny Dreadful wants to be, but Penny Dreadful fails. And League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is better. I still don't like love it. I have a hard time when I was ranting about this before about Penny Dreadful, but when fictional characters are repurposed for other media, I think you have to do it so well. Like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is to me the epitome of that, of plucking side characters or something like that and putting them in a different story. But League of Extraordinary Gentlemen does it exponentially better than Penny Dreadful does, which just, I don't really understand what they were going through.
I mean, the nice thing about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is it's very dedicated to its source material. So even when characters are different, like Hyde is huge. He's more of like a Hulk than like the literature Hyde. But they take a few panels to explain why that happened, and they take a little bit to explain Mina's backstory. And if you like the first two volumes of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you could dig into the Century volume, which is, it takes place over 100 years and with multiple characters, and like from James Bond to I think Jack Bauer from 24 is referenced in the last one.
Really?
And like all in between, all these characters sort of fold into a greater plot. And it's not something like other comic stories, like Fables or Unwritten, where these characters are talking about being fiction. They've just always existed in this fiction mashup world, and they're telling real stories. Like the second volume is essentially War of the Worlds happens to London, but these, you know, group of interesting literature characters are there to try and stop it. So that'd be my recommendation. And then if you really buy it and really dig it on a story level, Google for the notes. I think if you just search for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen footnotes, somebody has made an exhaustive series of internet pages that pinpoint every single reference in the text or in the drawings, and what book and what edition of that book, if it's very specific, comes from. So it's a huge rabbit hole if you want to dig into it.
Your answer is so good, and I obviously didn't do my homework, so I'm going to apologize for my much inferior response. But I did just read it, so it was fresh in my mind. So that makes me feel more confident about it, which is that I read Terry Pratchett's Dodger, which just came out, I think, 2 years ago, I want to say. And it's one of the few books that's not in his Discworld series. And I think it's skewed young adult, but it could be, you know, I'm an adult and I quite enjoyed it. And it has Dodger, the character from Oliver Twist, is the main character, but it's not fictional, because Charles Dickens is a character, Sweeney Todd is a character, all this stuff, like real people. And what it does, it's a rollicking adventure, Terry Pratchett, it's light, but what he also endeavored to do is bring in a lot of the real world problems, which is what Charles Dickens did, the real world problems of the different class systems in Victorian England. And so this is like the perfect example of plucking a character out, repurposing him, and just doing a beautiful job of it. So I am a huge fan of Terry Pratchett in general. I think he's a master of what he does. And this one's a little more serious in tone, but very educational and very interesting. So That would
interesting.
Be
interesting. A book-to-book adaptation.
Yeah.
You scoundrel.
Well, isn't that what League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is? Or you call that a book-to-comic book adaptation?
I mean, comic book seems limiting for this particular work of Alan Moore, so I'm not exactly sure. But, I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying, like, Dickens, man. That's a hard thing to be like, I think I have more to say about this world.
Well, it was so interesting. Like, I'll give you one example is that Sweeney Todd is a character, and we all, like, you know, either know the Burton version or the Sondheim version or whatever Sweeney Todd. But, you know, what this story posits is that Sweeney Todd is, a war veteran who's traumatized by the wars. And it's like, you know, a very modern idea, but set in this time of, like, people who come back from the wars and are just completely mentally unhinged, and there's no resources for them. And, you know, it's that sort of thing, which I just think is a really interesting take. And Terry Pratchett, it's widely known that Terry Pratchett has Alzheimer's and is sort of losing his grasp on his talent, his gift, but it's not showing in his work yet. I mean, everyone who knows him says that he is losing it, but he either has just a really strong team around him or what, but his last three books have been some of his best. So, all right, I'm done talking about Terry Pratchett now. Sorry.
No, that's awesome. Neil.
I think you guys are just too good at this. I don't know if I can, I don't know if I have anything.
What about like a book to a movie you like or something?
Or a movie to a TV show.
I mean, it's interesting, you guys, when we talked about this, I thought, you know, what are some of my favorite adaptations, you know, outside Game of Thrones? But I recently revisited Jurassic Park.
Yes.
The book version.
Yeah.
And I think it's really underestimated. I feel like it's interesting because Jurassic Park has had this interesting revival as a movie, you know, with a 3D re-release and all that stuff. So there's a lot of people that I've talked to who love the movie and have never really read the book or the book series, or they discount like the second book in the series because, oh, that movie sucked. And what they don't really realize is that the adaptation is not as direct as you'd think. And there's a lot of really cool stuff in those books. And there's a lot of really dense science and a lot of nerdy, just really, really good books that I remember reading. You know, that to me was the first kind of the seminal experience of reading something and then watching the adaptation.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we go through Game of Thrones, this obviously is the Game of Thrones is the adult professional version of that for me. But thinking back, Jurassic Park was the first time I had to go through that, where someone took a book that I really loved and made it into a movie and did extremely well. But, you know, I recently kind of revisited that book, and it's such a cool book.
Yeah,
so
I miss Michael Crichton.
I feel like a lot of people haven't done that. Like, a lot of people just saw the movie.
Yeah, I mean, no, I don't feel like a lot of people go in reverse a lot with movies. Like, I wonder what this movie was based on. It seems like that investigation doesn't necessarily happen a
sure
lot.
But you know, seems like, you're bringing that back.
Hopefully.
I don't know that that's, I mean, I don't know in numbers, but I do know that having worked in a bookstore, I do know that anytime a movie comes out, the book sees a huge jump, you know, like Hunger Games or The Help. And I'm not talking about like right before, I'm talking directly after. Mm-hmm. Like people walking over from the movie theater saying, I just saw The Descendants. Do you have that book? And I'm like, yeah, I got it. You know, like, so it is there. It might not be there in droves. And I completely agree with Neil, though, that Jurassic Park, everyone read it who was an adult when it came out. Everyone mm-hmm. read Jurassic Park. Neil and I were a little too young to read Jurassic Park, but we read it anyway.
It was a little scary for me.
It was very scary. Like, babies get their faces eaten off. But, yep. Like, I like right at the beginning, I was reading this book, and I was like, I probably shouldn't be reading this, but I'm going to keep reading it. But I think you're right that despite the fact that Jurassic Park is an evergreen film classic, I think the book, interest in the book, people aren't walking in and asking for a copy of Jurassic Park in the bookstore. And maybe that's because the movie is so good. You know, people don't feel the need. But it didn't. I know it's you know, Crichton, so it's never going to be like an evergreen like To Kill a Mockingbird. But like it is a good read. It's a great book, you know.
We need more like Crichton. When America forgot Crichton and picked up Dan Brown, it was a sad day for all of us.
Yeah. Well, Crichton, side note.
Yeah.
On the Crichton thing, the other thing that I thought of, kind of in opposite of Jurassic Park, was one of my favorite Crichton books was Sphere.
Yeah.
Yes. Sphere is excellent. The movie was terrible, but
it wasn't as bad as Congo, but Congo was never a great book. Sphere is a great
Sphere
book.
Sphere is such a good book, and it was so disappointing. Like, that was like the second round for me when I read Sphere, and I was like, oh my God, they're making a movie. I'm so excited. And then it was bad. And I was like, oh man, kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that the giant squid never actually shows up. I mean, he can't really, because it's like, just the whole premise of Sphere as a movie kind of blew up in their face. But I like Congo, because Congo the book and Congo the movie exist as two separate entities in my mind, and I enjoy both of them for being worse than they could have been. Just like, it's a beautiful thing. And then, last tangent, I ended up reading like the first quarter of Jurassic Park. My family read it out loud to each other, passing it around, because we were at a rain delay at a baseball game, but we had club seats, so we had an overhang.
That's,
and we're just like,
so
we'll just
cool.
stay until this game starts, and we were reading Jurassic Park to each other. So I was
wow.
also too young, but by the time we got to the baby face eating, the entire 4-person family was involved and having a moment. So that was just gonna happen. Anyway, guys,
wait,
I think...
really quickly, though, I have to tell you the most important story.
Yes.
Obviously, because it's about my cat. I took my cat to the vet yesterday. She has a bit of a cold. The vet said she should take lysine. And then the vet tried to explain to me what lysine was. And I was like, I know. I read Jurassic Park. I got
See, it's incredibly useful.
I didn't say that, but I was just like, yeah, lysine contingency. I got it.
Yeah, I know. My cat is anti-dinosaur. It just needs a little bit of anti-dinosaur.
Yeah.
That, I feel like, is a winding way to conclude this fantastic discussion about adapting things into television series on HBO and how we all feel about it. Guys, it has been my pleasure. Joanna, where could people find you until we return with the next season of Game of Thrones?
Well, are we going to talk more in depth about the t-shirts like I promised?
Okay, yeah.
Let's we don't have to. Just t-shirts. To let people know that there will be announcement. The shirts are coming. Watch us on... I'll talk about it a lot on Twitter when they're actually available. So is there anything more that needs
you
to be said?
You can find Joanna tweeting about the t-shirts.
Yeah. I think the easiest way is everybody who is involved in this show is free to help me communicate blasts to everybody off season at fightinginthewarroom.com/gotspoilers. So if that's just a good place to check up on us and what we're all doing and where you could see more of us, I think we'll kind of go into a hiatus mode there that will include links to t-shirts, maybe other things. I don't know. Maybe we need a sticker with a big X through some cold hands. These things can happen.
Cold hands, stone heart, can't lose.
But outside of Fighting in the War Room /GotSpoilers, where could people find you, Joanna?
Okay, sorry. You can find me tweeting about t-shirts on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me almost every day on VanityFair.com. You can listen to me talk about Legend of Korra on Republic City Dispatch. Jesus. And finally, I do a podcast about television called The Station Agents, which you can find those episodes at thestationagents.com.
Mr. Neil Miller.
You can find me on Twitter at Rejects. You also may, on certain days, be able to find me walking around the streets of Austin, Texas, handing out books from the A Song of Ice and Fire series, trying to get you to read them. And I will also very soon be writing more things about other things at filmschoolrejects.com.
Excellent. And I am Dave Gonzalez. I put my first name DA7E. That is also my Twitter handle. I write about superhero movie news and Star Wars at latino-review.com. Do a podcast about pop culture at fightinginthewarroom.com. And a podcast about Nickelodeon's Legend of Korra at republiccitydispatch.com. I feel like that's all the plugs. Guys, I'm going to miss all of you. I'm talking to listeners now, not you two. I'm going to miss all of you in the off season. It's been fantastic, and you have enriched television for me. I hope we've contributed a little bit for you. And now our watch has ended.
And who are you? The proud lord said that I must bow so low. Only a cat of a different coat. That's all the truth I know. In a coat of gold, a coat of red, a light. as long and sharp as yours. So he spoke, and so he spoke, that Lord of Castamere. But now the rains weep o'er his hall, with no one there to hear. Yes, now the rains weep o'er his hall, with not a soul to hear.
Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.